Welcome to another episode of Critical Perspectives with Tony Macklin. This is the most wide-ranging conversation I've had with Tony yet, as we discuss topics like the lack of diversity in today's cinema landscape, actors who fight against typecasting, and why we still believe movies matter. You can read Tony's criticism at his website at tonymacklin.net.
I'm listening to the radio today, to sports radio, and the guys are talking about the decline of Jim Carrey. And they were saying, oh, well, he played that comic, and they didn't know what the film was, Man on the Moon. And they said, oh, that was terrible. And I thought,
oh my gosh.
Wow. I mean, Miloš Forman directed one of the most humanistic directors in films, and the film was very human and very intelligent, and yet they wanted Jim Carrey to mug, and when he didn't mug, for them it was no good.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're in an age also where it used to be a fool with a fact could beat a genius with a generality. Now the fools don't need even a fact. It's my opinion, and it's like they win every argument because they say it's my opinion. And that has nothing to do with understanding. That has nothing to do with comprehension. It has nothing to do with getting into something. They just stay outside it and make their opinion and then dismiss it.
First of all, if the conversation is about Jim Carrey, Jim Carrey did not direct that film. He did not make that film. But speaking strictly as a Jim Carrey fan, that's the most astounding performance he's ever given in Man on the Moon.
I think it's his best performance. I agree. So how do you talk to somebody that says it's terrible? I mean, you don't even... There's one of the things that's a problem for a reviewer, a critic, is that some arguments you just can't find unless you suffer fools gladly. And I don't think either you or I do. You try and find a common ground into a film, but a lot of times it's just simply not there.
Well, and there's also in this kind of gossip-driven world that we live in, there's also the fraction of people that refuse to like anything that Tom Cruise does because he's gossip fodder. You know, so they've already dismissed Tom Cruise altogether. And they wouldn't be able to recognize a good performance from Tom Cruise if it bit him on the face.
And,
yeah.
And the people who really care and really are aware of things look at an actor, whoever it may be, whether it's Cruise or Jack Nicholson or Robert Redford or John Wayne, Duquesne, and they're not the same every time out. There's a change. There's an evolution. When I interviewed Duquesne, I said, why did you change your accent in this film? And he said, oh, you got that? You saw that? And nobody else, I don't say I'm the only one that did, but certainly that is not the common sense. Most people think, somebody was saying to me the other day, I was talking about John Wayne, and they said, well, John Wayne played John Wayne. Well, no. I mean, he had this persona that he applied and that you expected, but he could also play an anti-hero like Ethan Edwards in the Searchers. And if you don't understand, if you go in with a one-dimensional tunnel vision about anything, there's no way that you are going to get out of that tunnel and get beyond that tunnel and get into the light of understanding. And to me, it's so frustrating when people like that dismiss Carrey, who gives what you and I thought was a wonderful performance, or when John Wayne or Tom Cruise is not considered an actor, they are considered just a personality with a voice. And that's simply short-sighted and small-minded.
Here's another piece to this. And it's curious, and it is a challenge that I think we all face. When we're dealing with filmmakers that have made movies that have, you know, struck the zeitgeist, and have really taken off and defined their career. Say a Coppola, maybe, just to pull a name out of the air.
Right.
Do you have to resist the urge to compare whatever movie he does, the quality of whatever movie he does, to his best film? Or is that?
I don't think so. I think it's called context. That's very, very important because he is doing it as well. He's starting out. I hate to admit this, but when I write a review, I think, oh boy, this is the best review I've ever written. No, obviously it's not. But you go after the best that you can do. And so the director has this context, and he's also, he's fighting with himself. He's in the ring with Hemingway. Hemingway's fighting Hemingway. Coppola is fighting Coppola. And it also often takes an audience a long time to catch up with the filmmaker, that the filmmaker is going somewhere into new territory and is going to be more fertile than that which he has toiled in the past, and yet the audience is not prepared for it. So the audience, instead of being humble, what is humility? I don't think it's in the dictionary anymore because it's certainly not in the culture. But if one is humble, he approaches something with intelligence and sensitivity and not all the answers to start out with, and tries to figure out what the director was doing and what you can do in participating in his journey, in his pursuit. For you and me, for instance, we do not leave the theater and the film ends. The film continues. You rethink it, you get away from it, and you may go back and see it again, but you just ponder it, you mull over it, you decide what worked, and sometimes you'll have that lightning bolt that says, wow, now I see. I remember seeing Ballad of Cable Hogue, and I thought, what is Peckinpah doing here? Because I expected The Wild Bunch, and then I suddenly realized, maybe a day later, Ballad. It's a poem. It's a ballad. And that put it all into context or all into recognizable shape for me. And until I recognized that, I wasn't able to make a valid judgment of it. I was making a premature judgment of it. I was making one that gave me instant gratification. But anything that's meaningful has to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me, this is something else I've always been curious about from you. Do you feel that you have to review movies, each movie with a different criteria? That is, on its own, you have to review it on its own terms. I mean, what you
well, that see, Jimmy, you've just said one criterion. You have to view it on its own terms. I mean, you apply different terms because the film is made on different terms, but you still apply that, or I still apply that, to every film I see. First of all, trying to figure out what it was trying to do, how much it did it, and whether it was worth doing in the first place. But that is a singular, indelible criterion that I always apply when I see a film. Yes, you do go to a film, a comedy, drama, suspense, whatever, expecting something different and having to apply a different sense of parameters and see whether they fulfill that.
Yeah.
One of the things that has always struck me about film, and we wanted to talk a little bit about why audiences go to a film. Some go for escapist, and some go because it's art. And I'm baffled by people who say, I don't want to think at the movies.
I do hear that a lot. And any time I discuss a movie amongst people that aren't necessarily movie freaks, I always hear, yeah, well, you like that deep stuff. And not Not necessarily. I mean, I have an aversion to pretentiousness, first of all. But secondly, what's wrong with a movie that has some meat on its bones and stays with
nothing.
You?
Nothing. By the way, you've got to be careful about that pretentiousness and the director being self-indulgent,
mm-hmm.
because most great directors are self-indulgent and occasionally pretentious. You hope that they use their pretension for some means, for some reason. But I know what you mean. You don't want phoniness.
That's it, yeah. That's it.
Yeah, I think pretension isn't necessarily phony. It's just that you get a little bit arch and you get a little bit, there's a little more swagger than perhaps you should have. What I started to say to you was the two things. Every year I really hope to find at least one film that I can recommend to everybody across the board, no matter who it is. And three that came to my mind of films that I was able to do that, and I had a couple that came very close, but I could recommend to everybody Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's film. I just thought it worked, and I never had anybody come back and say, boy, you steered me wrong, or it was awful. Julie and Julia,
mm-hmm.
is just a delightful experience. I think most audiences left the theater elevated or enchanted. And then the third one, the new Star Trek with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto, that I thought that people might think the old Star Trek, and I just said, if you let this film work its magic, it probably will.
I'm so glad you brought up Midnight in Paris, because I think this elucidates what critics look for in a film beyond the general Joe Popcorn audience. Because Midnight in Paris is a perfectly delightful movie. It makes you feel kind of elevated when you walk out of the theater. And so it works on that level, but also there's something in that movie that talks about nostalgia and how our need for nostalgia keeps us from appreciating the present. And, you know, it's an important kind of thing that movie brings about. But it works on different levels, that film.
Well, you were talking about criterion that one applies, and I guess the one that is my basic criteria is that human, is the experience human. And if you go back into nostalgia and go back into tradition and back into the past and into your youth and into literature and culture, it has a resonance, it has a human resonance that really, I think, is almost undeniable. And if somebody said, boy, I hated that movie, I just wouldn't want to talk to him again. I think if the person is so insensitive, it doesn't mean they have to love it, but they have to at least, I think, understand it. And see, the one thing is that people do not like what they don't understand. And they will say it's no good, but they don't understand it. This was no good. This is boring, or this is, quote, pretentious, unquote. But it's because they don't understand what it's about, what it's doing. And so they're, of course, it's an incomplete, inchoate experience. And of course it doesn't make sense to them. And how do they like it? It doesn't mean that a work can't have mystery and can't leave you in some kind of state of wonderment and state of trying to figure things out. But the bottom line is it a human experience?
I think so too. I mean, that is the main criteria for me as well. But it also, I mean, there is an importance of knowing your film history in a way, because I think knowing Woody Allen and his particular obsessions, and the fact that each movie he does is another kind of slant on the same themes he's been exploring time and time again, I think going in with that knowledge deepens your appreciation
Well, not only that, but if you've only known Hemingway because you read The Old Man and the Sea back in 10th grade, the performance of Hemingway and the whole Hemingway quality is absent from your view. You you are ignorant to what is going on, and therefore it has no meaning for you. And you may say, ah, he wasn't any good. Well, he wasn't any good because he didn't play somebody else that you expected him to play.
And also, if you don't know the, you mentioned it with the Duke. I mean, if you don't know that persona and what he's going after, you don't know how he's playing with it from in certain.
And you don't give him the admiration. You don't give him the respect that he has earned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That you just put him into the mixer and say, oh, this is the Duke, or this is Clint, or whoever, or this is Ava, or whoever it may be, or this is Hepburn. And you don't really relate to it on a basis that can be very rewarding to you and is also the proper homage to the actor. Now, he may fail. He may do a performance. Newman did a film called Pocket Money that probably was a failure. It probably didn't work. But his trying only increased my admiration that he would go out there with Lee Marvin and make this kind of, not silly, but antic and motion picture. By the way, a couple of others that I was able to recommend to almost everybody. Last year was Ruby Sparks. Pirate Radio, I thought.
Yeah.
Now the people before rock and roll, probably it won't reach them. But
yeah.
Unstoppable, I thought was a very good picture.
I did too.
A very
yes.
good adventure, talking about its own terms. It's not a great film. It wasn't one of my best 10 of the year, but it delivered absolutely on what it tried to be. And then there's another film that I hope you've seen, and if you haven't, you should see it. Did you ever see Bottle Shock with Alan Rickman?
I did see Bottle Shock. He actually came on the show to talk about that particular
movie. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Now, the three of the films have what in common? Star Trek, Unstoppable, and Bottle Shock. All three of them had Chris Pine in them, the actor.
Oh, that's right. Chris Pine was in Bottle Shock.
Yes, he was a young guy. He was.
Oh, wow. So you're a big Chris Pine fan.
Well, I didn't know that. I didn't. Wife is. My wife is a fan of anybody who takes their shirts off. Any man.
Well, then she must be his biggest fan then, because
she's a very big fan of me. She, you know how we have thumbs up rating. Well, she has shirts ratings. This gets 3.5 shirts.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that's wonderful about movies, that's always struck me about movies, is the variety that's available. We have niche audiences, and the 70s are considered by many of us, myself certainly included, as the golden age of American cinema. In 1970, now listen to this, in 1970, these were the five films up for the Oscar. Airport, Love Story, well, they're generic popular films. Five Easy Pieces, which is very much about alienation. MASH, Altman's iconoclastic film. And the winner was Patton. Well, those are five, in a sense, films for Patton won, by the way, films for different audiences. And at the end of that decade, in 1979, I was talking about niche films. And what I love about movies is to discover one and then see that an audience has discovered it and that it worked for them. In 1979, Breaking Away, which was shot in Indiana about the stonecutters, blue-collar workers, and the bicycle racing at University of Indiana, Breaking Away, got a nomination, one of the five nominations as Best Picture. And the other in 79 were All That Jazz, Apocalypse Now, Norma Rae, and the winner, probably not the best of those five, was Kramer versus Kramer. But listen to those 10 films and look at how much variety there is, how much difference there is. Now, my question to you is, do we have that today?
In terms of Oscar nominations?
Not really. In terms of availability, more than Oscar nominations. I think the Oscars are a mess. I think Argo is a totally forgettable film. The one before that, what was it called, The Actor, is totally forgettable.
The Artist, yeah.
The one before that, The Artist. The one before that, Slumdog Millionaire, cute, but basically forgettable. I mean, it takes...
I think you have to go on demand or really seek out theatrical engagement for a lot of the movies that have a little more meat than the blockbusters. But then you're talking about Oscar nominations, and for me, a great year was 68. So in 68, a time of turmoil, a time of tremendous change,
right?
And also a time when the old Hollywood is dying out. So we have that year, In the Heat of the Night, Bonnie and Clyde, The Graduate, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and then almost as if the last clawing of the old Hollywood regime kind of stuck in there, Dr. Doolittle was the fifth nominee for Best Picture.
When I did my decade list, my first decade list of the best films of all time for Sight and Sound, I was so enamored of my experience in the theater with Bonnie and Clyde. It came out in 67 and got the Oscar, not got the Oscar, but was, I think she did as Best Supporting Actress. But that was an experience that I've hardly ever equaled it in a theater. I saw it in New York, and people left the theater and didn't say a word. I mean, after the movie, it was like everybody was in a state of shock, because we had never seen that kind of bloody mythology before. I mean, it was really striking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
well, I guess my point with naming those nominees is to say that I see very, very few movies comparatively today that actually have something to say about today. I mean, those were movies that really spoke to their time, that had something to say about what it meant to be a part of humankind at that time.
Right.
You know?
The elephant in the room, Republican or otherwise, is what the marketplace is. In days of yore, domestic grosses, the domestic money that films earned, were 80% and 20% foreign. Now, do you know that it's 20% domestic and 80% foreign?
Yeah.
And that, therefore, we're making films for an international audience that doesn't have much relationship with language, with the English language, and therefore language is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And how can you have character without language? It's extremely hard to do. You can do it if you're Buster Keaton, but there aren't many Buster Keatons around. David Elston made an interesting comment at the end of his review in the New York Magazine. He said, films today, and he was reviewing The Lone Ranger. He said, it's about truth and justice and the American way. No. He said, truth and justice in the Chinese way,
mm-hmm.
which is very interesting, because people are making movies for this international demand.
Well, in doing so, you have to examine every aspect of your film and make sure that it's palatable enough to appeal to everyone, like everyone the world over.
Exactly.
You can't afford to alienate an audience with these skyrocketing budgets.
But I had this hopeful trailer, trailer like a comet, of that, you know, despite the headlong, desperate pursuit of money, film has always had a place for the small film, the small intimate film. And two films I've been recommending recently, now one wouldn't work with a broad audience at all, but anybody who is a cineast who loves movies and the style and goes beyond the literal surface that appears on the screen, Barbarian Sound Studio is, I don't want to say intoxicating, because it's some people will think it's flat beer, but it is challenging, and it's the kind of film that you say at the end, "Whoa, I was talking about leaving the theater and it ended too quickly," and I said, "Whoa." So I wound it back up, and we watched the last 20 minutes of it on demand again, and suddenly it started to make sense. And the more, and one thing that's great for a critic is that as he writes his review, he deals with it on a level of insight and awareness and expectation and looking and all of those things that, if there is anything to be found, he perhaps follows that. And the other film is Broken. And you should see it just for two performances. The girl, Eloise Lawrence, is wonderful. She reminds me of the actress who played in A Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird. And Tim Roth gives his, again, I return to this human dimension, gives his most human, low-key performance that I've ever seen him give. And I was really pleased to see him attempt that, because I think he hit it.
I really love that movie too, and I saw that movie with a friend, and my friend liked it okay, but he said that a lot of the plot points he could easily predict, and I said, you know, sometimes a movie isn't about defying your expectations. Sometimes a movie is just about getting to the absolute truth of something. And the truth is something that we oftentimes know. We know what would be truthful here. And I thought that movie was very truthful about a girl's kind of burgeoning adolescence, that experience. I like that a lot, that film.
I think you're completely right. I don't think it dealt with what he expected in a cliched way. And if he wants to, he could read the book, which is harsher and perhaps has more unexpected happenings. But I thought that what they put on the screen was fulfilling, was satisfying.
Yeah, I thought it was very sensitive and truthful the way it was told. So let's get back to why people go to the movies, because if you believe that the demands of people relate to, you know, the kinds of movies that we're going to get. If you look at the movies back in the 70s, the Oscar nominees back when that we were discussing, and then you look at the movies of today, why are people going to the movies? Has it changed? What do they want to see now that they...
I think, again, you break it into target audiences. Obviously, the biggest target audience is that which wants thrills, that which wants explosions and multi-explosions and mega-explosions and hyper-explosions. That is a large part of the pie. But there's also, and I don't think people know about this audience much, there's a septenarian audience or octogenarian or even, who goes to the movies and finds things that you were saying there aren't any films, or there are very few films that are made about the experience today. I think a lot of these films for the older generation, people can understand looking back at the past and see themselves going through what Terrence Stamp goes through on the screen, or the group. What was the one that had the great ending of the real people in the home for opera singers and
Quartet?
Quartet, yes. Quartet. They can see that, and boy, is that a film that was made by its ending. When we realized that so many of the people were actual, it was made in the homes, and that's an audience that really never appears on the. It's not even a blip. And yet I know that it's a pretty loyal, granted very small, but loyal audience. I've talked to several people that have quite a number of years behind them, and they go regularly. We don't hear about them. And I think there is the independence, the independent movement that people are looking for independent films and the small, intimate, natural, interesting, provocative, controversial, whatever, provoking experience. So I think the audience just changes. I mean, it shifts. But there was always the blockbuster. Of course, there was the personal film before Jaws, and the personal film had a shelf life of not many years, but we can go back and look at the films of the 70s, which dealt with alienation, which is a wonderful, wonderful theme for cinema to deal with. Alienation is maybe the perfect film. We can go back and say, whoa, when Hitchcock first made his films, one-dimensional, director of suspense, that was it. And it took the French critics Truffaut and Cahiers du Cinéma to see in his work, wait a minute, there are levels, and there is actually a personal vision that here's a Hitchcock film, and here's a Hitchcock film that deals with similar concerns, similar attitudes. Whoa, this is a film that has great meaning. And I think that's true. That's true today. Of that, you can go find films. I mean, you have to search them out. But there are films where the director, this director of Broken, this director of Barbarian Sound Studio, have a personal vision. And so I would say yes, we're always in a capitalistic system, whether it be the studio system, or whether it be the let's sell this abroad.
Tell me if you think that this is an accurate assessment or not. It just came to my mind. The movies that people tend to flock to, the masses tend to flock to, do they relate to their own investment in the world? Because back in the 70s, there were, like I said, there were movies about that time, you know, in the late 60s, the war was raging, there was a draft, young people were active,
right,
which they are not today,
right,
and so they gravitated towards films that spoke of that struggle. Today, it's put your brain on hold and be as inactive as possible.
Well, that's a kind of a broad brush. I think a lot of people today, a lot of the young people today, want to be famous. Not for any reason, but they just want to be famous, which is also a broad brush. But there is a self-absorption in this generation. It doesn't mean that there's not a creativity bubbling or burgeoning, but so much of it is, and of course we don't really see it. We when's the last time you associated with a 19-year-old?
Well,
I mean, never mind. I think there's still a sense of creative people love creativity. And even if the society shunts it and spurns it, it still finds way to trickle through, to bubble up. I think, and the other thing is that I must admit that when I go to the theater, I look around at the audience and I say to myself, are all these people vampires? If you're talking about having their lives on the screen.
Looking at the younger generation, do you think there'll come a time when they're tired of the bombast, explosions, and destruction?
Have to be. Have to get that way. I mean, we can see already it's running its course. Films that are supposed to be mega hits are floundering. They're not doing that well. When I look, I couldn't make up a best 10 list like that right now. And I don't think I'd recommend this film to everybody, because I know one of your colleagues negated it. Mud, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's a very, very good film, and it goes back to my humanistic strain. And here's another actor that I think is underrated. I'll talk about two that I think are underrated. For all he has done and all of the chances he takes, I don't think Matthew McConaughey gets the attention he should get. And the other one, and here's something that's to me interesting. The young actor that I saw, that I said, this guy is going to be, if he can find his Scorsese, he could be as big as De Niro. And I had seen him in a film called A Mysterious Skin. And that's another one that I think everybody who has an affinity, a real affinity for film, should go see. And that's Gordon Levitt. And Joseph Gordon Levitt. And I kept saying, this guy is going to win an Oscar. I mean, he appears in Batman as a cop. He's in Hesher, but he may never have a role. He may never have an opportunity that equaled the one that he had in Mysterious Skin, which I thought was phenomenal. If you go back and look at two careers, Jack Nicholson and Robert Redford, Jack Nicholson's early films, directed by Bob Rafelson, Five Easy Pieces, and The King of Marvin Gardens. I like both of them. I think I was talking about Alienation. Neither Jack Nicholson, I think in my lifetime, is the actor that most embodied alienation, and then to see him in About Schmidt just about ruined me. I know it was a very popular film, but to give up your gift to portray alienation, he was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, obviously, another Milos Forman film. Think he almost became a not a cartoon, but when he played the Joker, and there was all of this praise and all of this attention heaped on him, he probably hasn't become the actor. He's a great actor, but he probably hasn't become as sustained, as more than proficient. The other one, if you look at the early films of Robert Redford and see Downhill Racer, and the other one that was directed by Michael Ritchie, The Candidate.
Yeah.
Both of them, he plays an empty man, which fits our past talk about Kubrick. Kubrick loved the characters who were banal and superficial and shallow, and he He was terrific in that. But then he made The Way We Were, and he became a star. And so there's always that do you chase after opportunity, or do you try to do something new and dangerous? Are you a risk taker? And I think that's always been a part of the business. And the business, unfortunately, when I taught at the university, they wanted a babysitter. They didn't want an educator who took risks.
Yeah.
I mean, if they pay the check, you give them the degree, there's no trouble cost. Oh, Macklin's caused trouble again. That's what they wanted. And I think that's, in a sense, part of our culture, that somebody has to be really strong, as Kubrick was from beginning to end, transcending the system. Now, granted, he made films that were personal and therefore not as popular as they would have been if they weren't personal. But I still think no matter what big business tries to do, no matter what commerciality tries to do, no matter what the market tries to do, no matter what capitalism tries to do, creativity will still live, and still perhaps prevail.
Well, and I do think that that's absolutely true in the case of someone like Matthew McConaughey, as you say, because I think he was so in demand for a stretch of time for all of those romantic comedies, and they were projects that were right there, and so he took them. And then I think he stepped back and said, you know, I'm just going to say no for a while until I get something a little more nourishing. And this is the act of his career that he's in now as a result of that. And I do think that he's going to win Best Actor next year, actually.
Really?
I think he might be nominated for Mudd.
For the one that's coming out?
The Dallas Buyers Club is the name.
Yeah, that's what I've heard about.
I mean, I just see pictures of him. I know that's like Oscar food right there.
Well,
just
it could be his time, but you just don't know. I mean, you don't know what the marketplace and the – you don't know what actor who's become a director is going to become the darling of Hollywood because he's been spurned, like Ben Affleck.
And I don't know when you look at somebody like Nicholson in Batman, I thought Batman was probably a worthy project for him because he had something very specific in mind with that character. He's always said he wanted to create a piece of pop art, and that would be fine if he did that, and that was kind of a one-off. But if you make that the definition of the remainder of your career beyond that point, just like Johnny Depp has done with the Pirates movies, just like Nicolas Cage started doing with all of his wannabe blockbuster films with Bruckheimer, you're wasting your particular gifts, I think.
Absolutely, sure. When Nicholson dies, and he's 75, he could live another 15 years, he could be a John Adams, but when he dies, they'll publish two pictures, one of him as a Joker, and one of him in the broken bathroom door saying, "Here's Johnny."
Yeah.
That will define his character. And my goodness, he's an actor who has done, we've talked about The Passenger, which a lot of people don't like because it was Antonio Zoni's vision and it wasn't expository, it wasn't literal, it wasn't clear, it was muddled, but I thought his performance was just right for that film. And I think it's almost like a politician, that you hear so much politics that you forget what you were. You lose who you are because it's all political. And in acting, you lose what you were, what you sought, because it's all money-making and prestige and popularity. And did you make the cover of Us, We magazine, whatever it is? And that's a real loss.
Yeah. Well, and plus these people, these great actors, they gravitated towards the collaborators that they could grow and learn the most from. So if you look at Nicholson, the extraordinary run of directors that he worked with, from Kubrick to Antonioni to Rafelson and Milos Forman and on and on and on. Tom Cruise is very similar. I mean, he only worked with the best. Dustin Hoffman worked with Fosse and Peckinpah in the same decade. I mean, extraordinary. I think that plays a big role, too. If actors have in their minds that they want to grow, then I think that's one of the primary considerations for them.
But the question we have to face is, in 2013, would they ever be given the opportunity to make a small film, a small intimate film? And maybe that's one of the reasons why recently we've had such a, I don't want to call it mediocre, so I won't, but not classic artistic films winning the best picture, because they picked smaller films, because the smaller films at least do have a kind of vision. If I see a film and I like it, I also want to read the best review by somebody who didn't like it and compare our thoughts and see whether he or she has valid points, and whether we understood it the same way. And the same way as when I don't like a film, I want to read the best review by somebody who did affirm it, to again see. And usually we see the same film. We just have we just approach it differently. We just have a different way in. I mean, one of your faithful listeners and my reader, Sean Ash, he really liked The Lone Ranger. And I could see why he did. I mean, I don't say he's wrong. I say, oh, he approached it as a summer movie. And my wife loved it. Judy loved it. And so, I mean, I trust Sean much more than Judy, but can you cut that?
Can I cut that? Yeah.
No, we won't cut that. We'll go down with the high time.
He'll be thrilled that you mentioned his name. I'm sure, because he listens to every minute of every show. So especially when you're on. This is the closing note I wanted to put on our conversation. For anyone that thinks that we've been too pessimistic, but so tell me why you believe movies still matter.
I still feel I'm still alive. When I go to a theater now, I must admit that I haven't been excited by much. Where I'm sitting there and I'm saying, "Boy, is this good! Oh my God, is this good!" One of the ones, I'm going to blow up my whole argument here, because I'm going to give you a film that I had a great time at that everybody hated. And I just got on it wavelength and wrote it like I'm scared of Ferris wheels. So I wrote it like a fast merry-go-round, but Cowboys and Aliens.
Uh-huh.
Now, people didn't like that, and people found, I mean, and it is flawed. But I love Olivia Wilde. I really like Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig, and it just worked for me. I'm not putting my reputation on that at all. I'm just saying that I felt the joy of movies that is part of our childhood and part of our best times at the movies. Why I did, why it suddenly clicked, I can't tell you. But I always go, perhaps, to the movies with trepidation and feeling. And yet, there's always the possibility that this film will be wonderful. What an experience writing about a film that you haven't caught. You're after this butterfly. and you haven't caught it yet. And when you finally catch it, you don't want to hurt it. You just want to be one with it, and it's wonderful, and it's marvelous. And that was what Barbarian Sound Studio was for me in writing that review. That once I mean, I could have written twice as long, but I didn't. I'd done duality so often that I didn't want to dredge that up again. But it was, for me, a remarkable experience.